Pilot Boys in the building. Welcome to the Pilot Boys podcast, where you'll get the real on all things sports, music, and pop culture. I am Mecca Don here with my co-host, D. Today is April 2nd, 2020. Thank you guys for tuning in. I know you could be anywhere in the world, but you're here with us. We are still quarantined and social distancing due to this coronavirus pandemic, but we are doing our best to bring you a show at all costs. On today's show, we will talk to my brother, an ER doctor and lawyer, Dr. Oke Onyejekwa, about what he's seeing on the front lines of the battle with COVID-19. We will also do some news and notes of popular sports, music, and pop culture stories from around the country, from the Michael Jordan docuseries, Bo Jackson, IG Live producer battles, NCAA eligibility, Nipsey Hussle, Tiger King, Ohio State, and more. Shout out to our Patreon subscribers. Remember now that our $5 and up Patreon subscribers will get our episodes on Wednesdays, a night early. These donations help keep our show going. If you want to help keep us on air, you can donate at www.patreon.com/Pilot Boys Podcast. Let's go.
Where the Pilot Boys at?
Pilot Boys, we get on up.
You're listening to the Pilot Boys podcast. Our next guest is actually my brother, but more importantly than being my brother, he actually has a lot of credentials that I think are very important. One, he's a physician, went to The Ohio State University for his undergrad and med school, did his residency at Columbia University, and he's also a lawyer, went to Stanford University and is barred in California. Please welcome to the show, Oke Onyejekwa.
Hey, what's up, Go Buck?
Yo, what's up, man? Feel like the Cuomo brother thing going on right now. The Cuomo brother, bro, man.
Right, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So we're gonna jump right into it, man, because, you know, obviously right now we're all kind of quarantined. We're all a little bit on lockdown. And, you know, it's very confusing kind of what's going on. Obviously, we're getting bits and pieces of information from news media, our local governments, and obviously national government. A lot of it doesn't necessarily seem to be cohesive. And the reality is that, you know, I think we're in a situation where a lot of what we do individually affects the collective. And so I kind of wanted to ask, you know, more specific questions just to kind of give people a little bit more insight on what it is that is actually going on and what it is that we should be doing from somebody who's actually involved and someone who is on the front line. So I guess my first question is, you know, you are on the front lines of this thing right now. You are an ER doctor in California. California is one of the states that's being, you know, hit the hardest by this. Tell us some of the things that you're seeing and dealing with that you feel like maybe the average citizen probably does not know.
Okay, sure. Yes, I am in California. I am an attending physician in an ER here in Palo Alto, which is in Santa Clara County. I believe the last numbers that I saw with respect to Santa Clara County is that we have the second highest number of COVID-19 cases in California, behind LA County. So it's affecting us here. I can tell you on the front lines, there are a number of issues, and you've probably heard variations of most of these, but I can tell you speaking firsthand, the one of the big issues is the providers are concerned about their own safety. Right. So we are taking extraordinary measures that I really haven't seen in my entire time of practicing. We're reusing masks as needed. We are sterilizing every single thing that we touch. I basically go through it's almost like a ballet of sterilization when I get to the hospital, wiping down my workstation, wiping down my phone, all the doors, all the chairs. This is what every provider is doing because we're not superhuman. We're just as susceptible to the coronavirus as anyone else. So there's that kind of fear, anxiety, concern. As you know, we're undersupplied. It's not just us. It's around the country and around the world. We know we're under-resourced if we get hit with bigger numbers. We've seen that in New York City already. Everybody's aware of this. We're making decisions now and having discussions now that are discussions that are difficult to have, which, for example, what do we do if we have to choose between a patient who needs a ventilator for a different respiratory issue and between a patient who needs a ventilator for COVID-19? How are we going to make those decisions? How are we going to make those decisions ahead of time? Who are we going to send home? People who we know are infected, who are we going to send home? Who are we going to keep in the hospital? We can't keep everyone in the hospital.
So these are yeah. real discussions because real. I think, you know, let's start here there too, because, you know, a lot of times people think that those things are being sensationalized a little bit on Twitter, or they're not real, or it's just, wow, that's not really how it happens. But, you know, you're telling us that is really how it happens. And these are discussions you have to have.
If anything, and I mean this seriously, it's being underreported. Mm-hmm. The real conversations, I mean, I cannot emphasize this enough. The real conversations, again, remember, many of us have kids at home. Many of us are not sheltered in place like most of the country is right now, right? Right. So most of the frontline workers are actually going out to work every day. We're not going out to work every day by ourselves. We're going out to work every day in a place where people are coming to us with suspicion or actual diagnosis of COVID-19. So mm-hmm. it's not even like a situation where you may be going in, you know, any other number of jobs where people are still having to go out and work. So that's real. I mean, that's just, I don't think the media will ever be able to capture that. Then the second piece of it that I think is real, really quickly, is that these decisions of what to do and how to, who you're going to manage when a capacity crunch hits are very real discussions. These discussions are happening every day and they're grim.
And, you know, touching back on the frontline workers, right, you guys are the country's line of defense in treating people with this issue. You know, we touched on the lack of supplies. It would seem like it would be imperative since, you know, there are only so many doctors and nurses. Are you facing issues within the hospital with staff getting the disease yet? Where you work, and if so, is there continue to be a supply shortage of masks? Have they started to rectify those situation, masks and gloves and protective equipment?
We had early issues with supplies. We were behind when this thing first hit. It started to improve a little bit, as I understand. And again, remember, this stuff changes in real time. But as I've understood from the briefings we got yesterday, we have a 2-week supply left, and we expect to have that replenished. But as of today, it's 2 weeks. We're also seeing with staff, basically any of our staff that has suspicious symptoms or a concerning exposure is being sent home for quarantine for 14 days. And so, you know, and that has happened. We have, so you can imagine what it means to send even one frontline worker home for 14 days during this pandemic. That's a big hit. And if we get hit harder, you know, as we are dealing with and everyone else is dealing with, it will be unsustainable.
Well, that's why I think, you know, first of all, this is very important, because I think people need to really understand part of why the social distancing thing is important, right? And I think, you know, maybe it's been, you know, the word itself or the term itself has been widely reported, but I think that the critical understanding of why it's necessary is something that I think is still developing, to be honest. I think some people still don't necessarily understand. And one thing that you kind of just made very clear to me is that what happens if the people on the front line, you know, the doctors, the nurses, the medical staff, what happens if you guys start to get sick? And even if you guys overcome it, because it's not just about who's dying, right? It's also about, you know, people who are sick and have to be quarantined for 14 days. What happens if you guys are understaffed and people are getting sicker at a higher rate, because this thing is on an incline as we talk today? What happens then?
Well, let me give a very, you know, and I'll admit, selfish kind of plea out there for people who may be frustrated with social distancing. It's frustrating for everybody. It's just something to think about. The you know, we're still getting data on just the actual lethality of the COVID-19 virus itself, right? So that data is still coming in. The data showing that it is more by itself, more lethal than, for example, flu, right? But what we're really finding out is that the issue is one of speed. The virus moves quickly. And so you can very rapidly overwhelm the resources you have to deal with it. If this was a slow moving virus, we could, in theory, take the sickest people, get them hospitalized, get them on vents with vents to spare, treat them for the 10 to 14 days that it would take to treat them, get them back out, and probably see a fairly manageable number of respiratory issues and deaths. But because it spreads so fast, at any given time, there's a potential that can be overwhelmed. So here's the thing from a frontline provider's perspective that matters with respect to social distancing. Every single time somebody comes to an ER or to a clinic, that person is potentially putting the staff at risk. Every single time we have somebody who goes out and has a barbecue and parties at the beach and disregards quarantine orders, those people may not be show symptoms, but they may hand it off to somebody who does, who then presents to our emergency room with symptoms and puts all of us at risk. And so when we see people blatantly violating stay-at-home orders or quarantine orders, when we see people blatantly doing sort of mocking things like coughing on food or you know, the other stuff that you've seen on the internet, for us, it is scary because we know at some point in time we're going to deal with the downstream effects of that. So even if it frustrates you personally to stay at home, which I understand, and even if it frustrates you personally to abide by these orders, the people who are going to be out there having to deal with your decision not to do that are us. And we're not going to be asking the question when you come to the ER, did you quarantine on? We're just going to treat you like we treat everyone else. So that's kind of my selfish plea, which is that just give us some time to stay ahead of this thing. Help us keep in front of this virus so that we can have the capacity that we need to take care of it. And do that. If you can't do that because you care, you know, necessarily about society in general, do that because you care about the frontline providers who are basically putting their lives at risk dealing with this.
And piggybacking on that, it seems, you know, we've talked to a few people who actually have gotten COVID-19, and it's not something that you would want to have, right? If you can tell us about some of the unpleasantries that people will deal with if they do face some of the more severe symptoms that come with this disease, beyond just the dry cough and a headache and a temperature.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a really good point, because we're talking about certainly mortality, right? And if you just want to focus on who's dying, you can look at it that way. But that's not really a proper view of public health and healthcare generally. It's also the people who are actually sick and dealing with the symptoms of the illness. The thing about COVID-19 that makes it difficult to manage is that for the people who become the sickest, so the baseline people, the sort of moderately healthy with very few additional comorbidities, those people tend to do okay. But even them, they're going to deal with fever, they're going to deal with cough, they're going to feel pretty miserable for about 10 days, 10 to 14 days. The people who get the sickest are going to present with the type of respiratory collapse that even without COVID-19 is difficult to deal with. I mean, the mechanism that we understand COVID-19 to the most lethal mechanism is when it progresses into something we call ARDS, which is basically acute respiratory distress syndrome. It's essentially a collapse of your lung capacity. Your lungs just don't function properly. It's not like asthma, which we can do things to kind of open up the airway. We can put a breathing tube in. Even with a breathing tube in place on a ventilator, if your lungs aren't able to move oxygen back and forth efficiently, which is what happens with again, this is a simplification, but which is what happens with COVID-19, even with the ventilator, you are going to struggle. And so that's why you're seeing, and it's miserable, you know, it's a miserable way it's a miserable 10 days, 14 days suspend. Certainly if you're not ventilated, it is a very scary time for the people who are ventilated, for the ICU team of clinicians who's handling these patients. It's very scary because ARDS is tough to treat always. And we know that it has a very high mortality rate always. And because COVID-19 tends to progress into either ARDS itself for all practical purposes or something very close to that, it is extremely scary. So it's not something you want to get. It's not something you want to sort of tempt and play around with. And again, the other issue is we don't really have real good, what we call pretest probability of who's likely up front, looking at them saying this person's likely the one to progress to ARDS and who's not. We just don't know that. We've seen in all age demographics, people get hit and suffer the respiratory failure in all age demographics, right? So, so very, very unpleasant illness to deal with for sure.
Okay. And kind of in terms of the treatment, obviously, Philip, as you touched on it now, the treatment for this disease, and again, why social distancing is important, like what we're looking at in terms of a timeline, to find some reliable treatment for this and how that will help the overall scenario and the importance of buying time.
Yeah, I mean, I would look at it this way. So in November of 2019, the world never knew that this virus existed. Probably, you know, somewhere around that time, this virus made its way into the human population for the first time that anyone's aware of. So
yes.
Nobody's been working on this. Nobody's been developing anything for this. This is all taking place over these, you know, sort of very accelerated several months. We have some treatments that are experimental that we have some anecdotes of working. I caution people not to be overly optimistic with anecdotes. Almost any treatment that you've heard of, even the ones that have been failed and have been toxic and lethal, had anecdotes. Total evidence of working, you know, in a small population. It's not really till you get to population-wide, hundreds of thousands, in many cases millions of people, before you can really understand the benefit of something and the risks. So you're seeing already we've had some short-term approvals from the FDA that have accelerated, almost in a humanitarian way, use of drugs we've had for a while, like hydroxychloroquine, to basically a last ditch effort to try to use in a situation where nothing else is working. But I caution people to not be overly optimistic with that. Same with vaccination. Vaccination, even if a candidate was to appear today that was a viable candidate, you couldn't just put that out in the population right now. We have to know that by giving that vaccine, we're not going to do some long-term damage 18 months from now, 2 years from now, et cetera. The vaccines that we use, you know, most of the childhood vaccines, for example, they've been studied for so long, we know what the risk profile for them is. So even if a vaccine were to emerge today, it would take, you know, it's probably 18 months before you could ever have any confidence that you could get it out to the population safely.
So
the short answer is that while there are some treatment options that look promising, we're not at a point yet where anyone's thinking that we're just going to start handing out pills or vaccines and get rid of this thing tomorrow.
this has all been really, really great info. You know, the takeaways for the audience is to stay at home, take care of your frontline workers because we need them and make their jobs easier. But transitioning a little bit, you know, just to the other side of your career, the legal side of this, we're curious to hear what you see some of the big legal challenges or that will come up as a result of COVID-19 that you see either now or that are going to be coming down the pipeline.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So one, I'll say they go hand in hand, right? So the longer this thing lasts, the more types of legal issues we're going to see. But I can tell you one big one that is going to come is we're going to see there's going to be some significant economic fallout. People are going to lose jobs. There are going to be layoffs. And many people are going to, as a result of that, going to struggle to get health care and going to have to make some even tougher health care decisions. So there's that. That's definitely coming. That's and happening already. In California, for example, amongst some of the good things that California has done with respect to the stay-at-home orders and whatnot, they've also allowed for employers to waive the normal statutory requirements for the amount of time it takes to lay off an employee. Right, so if you're doing mass layoffs in California, it used to require a waiting period. That's been waived now. So,
oh, wow.
Sometimes the employers pushed for and got, and so there's that issue. There are going to be contracts between entities that are going to be breached, that are already in breach. You know, you can everything from Hollywood contracts to start movie production. An actor signs a contract, says we're going to pay you this amount of money, we're going to start shooting this day. That contract's void now. Who's going to cover the damages for that? Is it going to be the actor? Is going to have to eat that? Is it going to be the studio? So you can see that situation with rent and leases, office spaces that are sitting empty right now, entirely unoccupied. Companies are paying for a lease at the space they're not using. Those leases are going to increasingly lead to litigation. There'll be breaches there. So these are we're going to see investor lawsuits from people who feel like their projections were misleading or maybe there was inside information that wasn't shared. Whole number of things. I mean, this is going to be a field day for litigators for years to come, right? So the fallout from this is going to be pretty heavy. Think of all the TV deals that are canceled now.
Yeah.
With respect to sports, for example, you know, someone's got to pay for that. I mean, none of these things are people don't just walk away, shake hands, and say, "Look, well, you know, we did our best." Someone's going to say, "Hey, look, you owe me."
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we've been hearing a lot generally about these act of God provisions that are typically in contracts. Mm-hmm. Yes. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so some contracts have provisions. They're called force majeure provisions. I don't remember the origin enough. I've certainly forgotten my Latin from high school, but French or whatever it is. But anyway, they have these provisions in there that allow for suspension of the contract terms in the event of something akin to an act of God. So, which this certainly would qualify as, you know, a pandemic, a tornado, you know, something like that, hurricane. So those provisions are in there. But keep in mind, that still requires interpretation. As to what that is, it still requires a showing that you were affected, right? So, you know, it may take an office lease, for example, and you were told that you had to shelter at home. Well, there's certainly an argument that can be made that, well, if you were a healthcare worker, for example, or you were physician's office, you could have come in because you were an essential worker. You could have come in and used the space. You chose to stay at home. et cetera. So you can see how lawyers could even with those clauses make arguments. And many modern contracts don't have those clauses in them at all, right?
Yes. Like,
or they expressly say, I think it was the South by Southwest example that I saw recently where they actually have in their license agreements with the end user, the purchase of the tickets, even under acts of God, your tickets will not be refundable. So you're going to see litigation over things like that as well, right?
Yes, it's we've got a big mess ahead of us. Definitely want to thank you for taking the time, and thank you for your work on the front lines. This conversation obviously is going to be the first of many. We look forward to having you back throughout this time. I appreciate you making the time to talk to our audience about what's going on.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to do it anytime.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Love the Pilot Boys podcast? Support us on Patreon. Supporters can pledge as little as $1. And we have some cool perks on there. Check out www.patreon.com/Pilot Boys Podcast. Show us some love today.
You're listening to the Pilot Boys Podcast, episode 21. Time for some news and notes. Dee, first, before we get to news and notes, man, that was really good content with my brother, man. I mean, you know, we always obviously have these conversations privately with him, but I think it was good for us to bring it to the podcast.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I think it's important for everyone out there to hear from people who are having real experience with this disease so that they can get a greater understanding of why everything that's happening is happening and why to stay your ass at home.
Right. And speaking of that, before we jump into some of the more sports and pop culture stuff, you know, national social distancing, you know, has been extended from the national government until April 30th. I personally believe that number is going to be extended even further than that. The states are kind of being more restrictive, like we said in June. In Virginia, they've extended theirs to June 10th. Ohio is, you know, pretty much till May 1st, but I think that's probably going to be extended a little bit longer. What do you feel about social distancing, like personally, not like the concept of it, but like personally, you at home, social distancing, how do you feel like on a day-to-day basis doing it?
I actually don't mind it. You know, I do have a kind of an introvert side of my personality. It's given me an opportunity to have time to read and absorb new knowledge and learn about new things. So, and then with the connectivity of the digital world, you know, with FaceTime and phone calls, text messaging, I'm able to actually have conversations with people that are usually typically too busy or I'm too busy to have conversations with.
Right.
So, you know, that's my personal experience. I know that this is challenging, especially for people who are very social and engage in a lot of social activities. But, you know, this is something that we're all equipped for as human beings and take advantage of it.
Yeah. And I think the balance of, you know, obviously spending, you know, time with my family, which is always important. And, you know, but obviously trying to keep this show going, you know, as people can tell, you know, we're calling in to kind of keep the show going, to make sure we social distance properly. And, you know, obviously, you know, balancing even on social media, you know, the need for sports and, you know, fun content, but also the need for seriousness and making sure that we do use our platform for good, not to cause panic, but to make sure that we are bringing, you know, good content. Like, for example, what we brought today, the coronavirus obviously has extended into sports. One of the things that it's extended into is NCAA, right? So a lot of the, you know, the spring athletes, for example, their seasons were cut short, a lot of them before they even got a chance to start. Winter athletes' seasons were absolutely cut short. They definitely didn't get a chance to get in the championship season. But the NCAA this week officially granted spring athletes another year of eligibility, which is a great sign, you know, a great thing. But, you know, then comes the question of, well, what about the individual schools? Are they going to provide aid for them if they come back? Ohio State is one of the leaders. They came back and said they will provide aid for their spring athletes that come back next year. I assume that a lot of the big programs will follow suit. But one of the most glaring issues is that winter athletes are not getting this additional year of eligibility. And I think that's one of the saddest things to me about this is that, you know, for people who needed kind of, you know, who have aspirations of going pro or aspirations of using, you know, whatever the championship season would have brought for them for the next step in their careers, they're not going to get that opportunity.
Or even if it was really their last hurrah, they weren't going to go to the next level.
Yes.
to have that taken away. I know Ohio State with March Madness, we had a couple seniors that weren't going to get the opportunity, and our women's basketball team actually was going in with a ton of momentum.
Yeah.
So it's definitely tough, but I mean, I think these situations, as always, are for these kids are going to be something in the long haul of their life is going to be something that they learn valuable lessons from, and, yeah, and hopefully helps them in the long run.
That's absolutely true. So we'll see again, as this thing continues to develop, we will see, you know, how this affects people. And again, you know, it's great that you have another year of eligibility, for example, but you know, not everybody's life is set up around eligibility. You know what I mean? Like, you know, that's a whole other year that if you had plans of moving somewhere, or you had a job potentially lined up, or,
yeah,
you know, you had other things that you wanted to do with your life. I mean, again, it's great, but it's just, you know, it's been cut off. Again, it's nobody's fault. You know, this is obviously, you know, as a result of what's happening with the virus, but it's sad, even though obviously the sadder thing of this is what's happening with the disease and people dying. I think there are other stories that are also sad that can also be talked about. But one thing that has been good, again, and we talked about this a little bit on last show, is, you know, some of the creativity that we've seen as a result of this kind of down period. And you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, being able to get in touch with, you know, people and other sides of, you know, things and your creativity. And one of the things we've seen on social media, Instagram particularly, like we saw DJ D Nights with the Club Quarantine. He's actually registered to trademark that, which I think is very smart. And then we've seen some producer battles, like between Timbaland and Swiss Beats and Hit Boy and Boy Wanda. And there are a lot more of these kind of popping up. Neo, I think, was involved in one, like a songwriter battle. What do you think about these kind of battles, and have you been tuning into them at all?
I've been tuning into some. And obviously, one thing that is great is I do feel like people are getting creative, and there's a ton of content out there for whatever you're looking for. If you can seek it out, you can find it. It's great that these people are providing opportunities for people to entertain themselves. And again, a reminder that, you know, in the digital world that we live in, being stuck at home, you can look at it one of two ways, as an opportunity or a curse. And with all these digital outlets and these celebrities giving us all this free content that we would normally have to pay for, you can look at that as one of the benefits.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, I've tuned into a couple of them. Obviously, you know, Timbaland, Swiss Beats, Hit Boy, Boy Wanda, as an artist, you know, I listen to those producers for decades, obviously, now. And so just to kind of hear that has been really cool. And like you said, it's pushing people's creativity to the limits, right? You know, it's not that you can't do the traditional stuff that you've done before to get people's attention. You know, have to do other stuff, you know. And one of the things that I think is actually interesting about this kind of period of time is that now a lot of us are kind of forced to tune in to a lot of the same things, because there isn't as much content as there typically was. And so there are two things that I think, one we've been forced to tune into, and the other one that which we're all going to tune into, probably regardless of when it drops, but is this Tiger King thing. I personally have not seen it yet, but I can't go 5 seconds on Twitter without seeing somebody talk about Tiger King. I think you've seen it. Just tell us what you're talking about.
I don't know what it is. It's like, I guess this is like what a drug does to people, like an addictive drug. But once you start watching this thing, it's addictive. Like, it's so beyond the realm of belief, but it's an actual true story. Wow. Of these crazy tiger cults and zookeepers. That it just keeps you engaged. You know,
how many series is it? Is it like a series, or is it?
It's seven episodes. Okay. It's a seven episode series. And so it follows a bunch of different, essentially private zookeepers who, basically exploit, tigers and large cats. And it shows like their inner competition and all the shady bunch of characters and the cult-like atmospheres that exist. It's just fascinating that, you know, there are pockets.
So is it worth watching? I mean, I haven't watched
it. Oh, it's definitely watching. It's well worth watching.
Okay.
Especially during these times, it's entertaining, you know.
And it'll get extended beyond this one.
I don't know, but it's pretty much 7 hours. If you're bored and you're looking for stuff to do, there's 7 hours of content right there that will keep you entertained and engaged and probably make you feel better about your life.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out. And then the other thing that was announced, which I think is, you know, interesting, is the Michael Jordan docuseries, The Last Dance. It's been pushed up to April 19th. It's going to air on ESPN. And, you know, that's them pushing it up, I think it was supposed to air originally in the summer. And, you know, I think it's like a 10 or 20 year documentary, basically, where they followed his life and have interviews from everybody. I mean, every single person you could think of is involved in that. And there was a bunch of social media pressure once this social distancing thing took place from everybody, you know, big names, you know, LeBron and, you know, the likes, to try to get this thing pushed up. And ESPN obviously obliged. I think obviously one is, you know, the public pressure and the hype. But I think the two is they need content. They need to keep eyeballs in there on their screens. And this is one of those things that, this is kind of what I was mentioning earlier, that, you know, in 2020, it's very unusual for all of us to be watching the same thing at the same time in real time, right? Because there's so many different outlets and there's so many different shows and, you know, whatever. But this is going to be one of those things that seems like, I think, pretty much everybody's probably going to be watching it.
If anything shows the power of LeBron James over ESPN and their decision making, it's this. Literally, like 24 hours after he says it, it's done, right?
So, yeah, right.
But yeah. I think, you know, I think personally, you know, I wouldn't mind if it was a 20-part, 30-part, 40-part series.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard. I think, you know, I get a lot of flack because people don't think that I give LeBron the type of credit that he deserves. And it's not a knock on him. He is obviously objectively great and one of the greatest players ever to play. But Michael Jordan kind of created the opportunity and the mentality for guys like Kobe and LeBron to mimic and follow. And they both have admitted as much. And I think it's useful for this generation who probably don't know much about Michael Jordan beyond the sneakers, because it's been almost 20 years since he's more than 20 years since he's stepped foot on a basketball court. So I think, you know, just understanding the greatness and what this man put in to be the greatest of all time and why.
That's it. You just said something that I think is very important, is what he put in to be the greatest of all time. And I want to take it back, you know, a little bit to Michael Jordan's story. You know, Michael Jordan, you know, he was one of the great basketball players in the country, right? But he wasn't like, people have revisionist history a little bit when they talk about Jordan, right?
Yeah.
He, you know, he played 3 years in North Carolina, right? He didn't come out of high school like LeBron did or KG did or Moses Malone did. He played 3 years.
And he was cut from his high school team. Everyone knows that story.
Yeah, he didn't make varsity. You know, he wasn't the first pick in the draft. You know, yeah, he was top three, but he wasn't first pick. People didn't necessarily, it wasn't unanimous that he was going to be the best player ever. And then he also went through trials and tribulations before he won. He went through the heartaches of losing, you know, to the Pistons, obviously, is the big one. And you know, through the stories of people saying he's a ball hog and that he can't win and all that type of stuff, it wasn't like he just came in and immediately had success, at least from a winning and championship level. And then when he finally did get to the point where he was able to overcome those hurdles, he paid his dues, he put in the work, he became a champion, and he never really let go of it.
And even at the peak, and the unique thing about him is at his peak, he had to deal with his father being murdered at the peak of his, and going through that process that many think is the reason that he had to walk away from the game.
Yeah. He wasn't there during the social media moment. And that's to take it back to the docuseries a little bit. He wasn't really there during the social media era. So there's probably a lot of gaps that, you know, us as fans, or, you know, even if you weren't a fan, even if you're a Jordan hater, there are probably a lot of gaps that are going to get filled in as we watch this docuseries. I mean, I think when it comes to like LeBron and even Kobe a little bit, we know almost every, it feels like we know every aspect of their lives pretty much. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, there's certain things that could be filled in a little bit, but this one is going to be, you know, this one is one that we haven't seen. We're going to see stuff that we hadn't seen before.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, so I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
The ratings are probably going to be, I can't even imagine how well ESPN is going to do by releasing this early.
No, it's going to be crazy. It's going to be crazy. And, you know, it's funny. Actually, we've been talking about legends, you know, on our social media. We've been posting a bunch of kind of throwback stuff, and we had a lot of stuff go viral, including this Bo Jackson tweet that we put out earlier this week or late last week, you know, the video of him when he was in, later in his career, when he was in Chicago and he threw somebody out all the way from, you know, the right field all the way to third base, not with, without even crow hopping or anything, and after hip surgery and everything. And, you know, that video went viral. I mean, I think it got 260,000 views in a couple of days, and, you know, Bomani Jones and a lot of other top sports people got involved and kind of created a whole conversation around Bo Jackson and his freakness and whether or not is he the greatest athlete of all time. So I ask you, V, you know, I mean, there are not really that many people that we can probably put in that conversation. I mean, there are really maybe 10, and Jordan is probably one of them, but there are probably, you know, 10 or less people that we can put in that conversation. Deion Sanders, you know, LeBron has to be in there, you know, Usain Bolt, you know, Jordan, you know, Serena, all that stuff, Tiger Woods, you know, where do you, how do you view Bo Jackson?
I don't think Bo Jackson can be categorized with any other athlete that we've ever seen before, because he was great at so many different things. God was in some sort of a special mood when he created this guy, because he could have, you know, beyond baseball, first of all, being a two sport professional athlete, yeah, and excelling at the level that he did at both. Everyone knows about that. I don't know if we'll ever see a two-sport professional athlete again. Deion Sanders, definitely.
Yeah.
But the other thing about Bo Jackson is he actually qualified for the U.S. Olympic team coming out of high school. I think he still owns a couple state records in, like, the high jump and triple jump. And then even after his career, he's like an archery champion now. Like,
they said Deion was at Olympic speed too, though. I mean, I'm not. He was. I think
there's a different level of freakism. Deion's number one attribute, obviously, he's a lockdown corner, right? But as baseball player, his number one attribute was speed.
Stealing bases, yeah.
And stealing bases. I mean, what we had in Bo Jackson. You know, everyone's seen the Tecmo Bowl videos, but that was literally what he did on the football field. Like, there are books that have been written just of, like, these superhuman, like, anecdotes and little stories of Bo Jackson saving drowning kids and all kinds of crazy stuff that he was doing back then, that if it was happening during the social media era, I think the generation and of course his hip injury, we definitely would be looking at Bo as the greatest athlete of our time. And if he had a little bit more of a affable personality, that's one thing that he lacks, is he's kind of a introvert and kind of an asshole.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think Bo is probably the greatest athlete of all time, but I do think that we have seen some special athletes. And talk to us on Twitter, guys, at Pilot Boys Pod. Let us know what you think. You know, obviously Deion Sanders has to be in the discussion. You know, he played two sports, and people did say he had Olympic speed and was a great basketball player. Randy Moss, another one. LeBron was all state at basketball. Allen Iverson, all state at football.
But I think it comes down to Deion and Bo, because they both did it.
They both actually did it.
They actually did it. Yep.
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, obviously that's an interesting conversation, and we'll continue talking about that again on social media. Like I said, hit us up at Pilot Boys Pod. Let us know what you think. I want to switch gears real quick back to Netflix. Couple shows. One, let's talk about The Messiah. That show, we talked about a little bit before. I absolutely love that show. You were the one that put me onto it. When I first started watching it, I did not realize that it was only one season. I don't know if I'm happy or not happy that I knew that when I started watching it. But when I got to the end, I realized it was only one season. And then now it's just announced officially that they're not going to renew it. And that just drives me nuts.
Yeah, I mean, they will renew shows like The Tiger King, but shows like The Messiah frustrates me when you see shows like The Messiah that do have deep meaning and perspective, for them not to gain the same type of traction as some of these more salacious shows. It's just kind of the times we live in, right?
Yeah, you touched on it. I think it's not gaining the traction, right? Because obviously this has to be a numbers thing, right? If they had the numbers that justify whatever expense or whatever slot or whatever it is, that metrics that they use to determine whether or not they're going to continue investing in something, they weren't able to hit those metrics, which is surprising to me, given the quality of the show. But we also know, people like us who've been in promotions for a long period of time, we know that it's not always just about the quality, right? It's also about its promotion, its marketing, its, you know, timing. It's a lot of other things that go into it. And hopefully, you know, I don't know if there's a way, you know, sometimes these movements happen on social media and people put enough pressure and some celebrities get involved and some money gets thrown in and all of a sudden they change their mind and they decide to renew. I'm hoping something like that happens with that show. But I guess, you know, we'll see. And then Ozark, again, another show I have not seen. As you guys can probably tell, I'm not like Mr. Netflix, but I am starting to try to get involved. And I guess season 3 of Ozark just started. People are going crazy about it. I know you've watched that show. What's your thoughts on it?
It's one of the best written and best acted shows on TV. I mean, Jason Bateman is the core character. I know many people have gotten used to him as a comedic actor, but this show takes a more of a dramatic and serious turn, as opposed to the glorification. We see a lot of movies and shows about the glorification of girl culture. This is more of a grassroots, blue-collar, take away the sex appeal of this thing and show it for what it really is.
And what is it? Is it a crime? Is it crime? What is it? What? Give us just a little bit of what.
Yeah, it is. It is a crime. Drug-based show, but not in the traditional sense. You really have to watch it. It takes place in a small, sleepy town, away from the big city, and the characters, the cast of characters, and who they are in this small. Small town as it's just you have to watch it.
Okay, I definitely gonna check it out. Yeah, I mean it's now, like you said earlier, now's a good time to kind of catch up on the things that you missed out on. You know, I've been asleep at the wheel when it comes to a lot of shows that people talk about on Netflix and Hulu and different places, and so now I'm gonna catch up on it. But Ozark season three just started and people are going crazy about it. I'm sick of seeing all these things on my timeline that I don't know about, so I'm definitely going to get involved. And I guess the last thing on news and notes before we go is, you know, March 31st was the one-year anniversary of Nipsey Hussle's death. You know, rest in peace. Very tragic death. Again, he was shot to death right in front of his Marathon store in L.A. last year by someone that he knew on March 31st. And it's been a year, man. And you know, what do you feel like has happened? You know, obviously we're sad about it and we'll always mourn him. What do you feel like has happened in this year when it comes to Nipsey Hussle's legacy and impact kind of in society?
I mean, I think as with most things, right, when it happened in the first month or so, you had a lot of people who joined the wave, right, because it was such a big story. And you saw everyone posting about Nipsey Hussle and naturally, over time, some of those people drifted off like they always do. But I think there is a nice core group of people that you see that consistently took the messages that he was trying to enlighten people with to heart and have applied it to their own lives. And that's what you hope to leave with a legacy, you know. And especially during these times, there's a line that goes through my head often that he says in one of his songs where he says, "We never let a hard time humble us." And that's what we're going through as a country right now. And I've revisited some of his music, and to stay positive and to stay ambitious through dark times is kind of the story of his life, right?
Yeah.
And that this is a marathon.
Right.
So those are my takeaways and my feelings. I don't know how you feel about his continued legacy and what you feel like you're saying.
Well, I mean, the thing that's so amazing to me, first of all, it's amazing how many interviews he did, right? And how many, and not just how many interviews he did, but the type of gems that he dropped in the interviews that he did. In fact, a lot of the interviews that you see posted of him now are not really about the music. I mean, obviously, they always relate to the music a little bit, but it's about life. You know,
yep.
One thing that I love about him is that he kept his story very real. He was never trying to be someone who he wasn't. He was never denying his past. He was actually trying to use his past in a lot of ways as a tool to fuel him towards greatness, right, and enlightenment. And so he left us so many gems. And one thing that I've definitely seen is that a lot of people who were never exposed to him are now posting quotes of his and posting, you know, clips of his videos or clips of his interviews. And I think that he's really touched a lot of different people. The more his story kind of comes out and people hear about the things he was trying to do in the community and things he was trying to do for the next generation and, you know, STEM programs he was starting and the way he operated his business and so on and so forth. I think he's really, really left a mark, and it continues to grow daily. So,
yeah, one of the great takeaways from him, and one thing that stood out to me, is that even as a celebrity, he seemed to be someone who constantly stayed humble and constantly sought knowledge and didn't fall in love with the attention of celebrity. He had a goal beyond being famous, and that's what made him famous. That's what's really special about him.
Absolutely. And so, you know, again, it's been a year since Nipsey Hussle's passing. RIP Nipsey, we will continue to rock and rep you indefinitely. And obviously, we pray for Lauren London.
The marathon continues.
Thanks. You're listening to the Pilot Boys podcast. That's the end of news and notes. That's all we have for today's show. Big thanks to our guest, Dr. OK Onyejekwe. Thanks to everybody for listening. Don't forget, sharing is caring. Subscribe to the Pilot Boys podcast on Apple, Spotify, Patreon, and YouTube. And please follow us on social media at Pilot Boys Pod on Twitter and at Pilot Boys Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And follow the hosts on Twitter. I am at Mechadon Music and V is at The Swan. And don't forget to grab some Pilot Boys wristbands at shop.pilotboys.com.
Always remember, be you. You is fly.
Pilot Boys out.
Where the Pilot Boys at?
Pilot Boys, we